Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. A few days ago, Anthony had a fascinating interview with Harry and Nancy Johnson. They're an interracial couple who had to resort to something known as ghost buying to purchase their home in Brookline.
Ghost buying was a practice used in and around Boston back in the 1950s and 60s. That's when African-American families, many African-American families, were denied the right to buy homes in all-white neighborhoods. So they would recruit whites to front for them and help them buy the house.
Well, last night, we saw a new play about this complicated chapter of Boston history. It's called The Luck of the Irish, and it's the story of two couples, one black and one Irish, and how the specter of ghost buying haunts both families for 50 years. Here's a scene from the play.
We've got the communion coming up, so we'll be needing you to move out by the first.
Now, Mrs. Donovan, you and I both know everything was signed 50 years ago, and this house
is borrowed luck. That's what it is. And now that the people who borrowed it are gone, not to mention how this place skyrocketed, you do the math and you realize what we took isn't even a tenth of what this place is worth.
We live here, Mrs. Donovan.
My girls shared a bed.
Your girls are senior citizens now. They can buy their own beds.
The Luck of the Irish is playing now at the Huntington Theater.
And we're joined in studio by playwright Kirsten Greenidge. Welcome to Radio Boston, Kirsten.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Kirsten, you grew up in Arlington, and this play, I understand, while not about your grandparents, is somewhat inspired by their experience. Can you talk a little bit about that?
It is. Growing up, my mother always told us stories about how my grandparents bought their house in Arlington, and she used the term ghost buying. That's when I first heard about it. And her story was that my grandparents enlisted a family friend who was a neighbor here in Boston in the South End to go with my grandmother and check out the house. And they dressed very nicely. And on the surface, without anybody speaking, it kind of seemed like my grandmother was the family friend's housekeeper or maid. And they would look at houses. And this particular house they had was on the street where my mother went to school. So they knew it was near her school. And it was very large enough for their family of three kids. And they went to check out the house and acted as if the friend was buying it. And my mother was always quick to say that buying a house then didn't involve all the paperwork that it does now. So it was really a handshake. I like your house. I'll buy your house. Done deal. And that's how we learned about how my grandparents bought their house in Arlington.
But it was sort of shrouded in secrecy over the years, right? I mean, in terms of really getting to what this story was about, it wasn't so straightforward. Right?
Very much so. My grandparents were very, very proud people. And I think there was a sense of shame is a very strong term, but a sense of shame, a tinge of shame, in that that's how they had to buy their house. They couldn't outright go look at it and purchase it. And so nobody really talked about that in my family.
Mm. Well, listeners, we are talking about ghost buying, and a little later we'll be talking about redlining, but all the issues about race and real estate in greater Boston. Well, when you hear Kirsten Greenidge's story, does that sound familiar to you? Did your family experience something similar from either side of the buyer-seller black-white divide that existed in Boston for so long? Give us a call and share your story at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And do you think things are better now, or maybe just even a little more subtle and more complicated? Kirsten, I really enjoyed seeing the play last night. And one of the things that I enjoyed the most was that this isn't just a good versus bad story. All the couples, both couples, the Taylors, who are the black family, and the Donovans, who are the white family, are really complicated. Can you tell us a little bit more about why you just didn't want to make it a straightforward story of a black family not getting its due?
Well, I think it's always really important whenever I write any play that every character is whole and is a whole human being, as whole as you can be on stage. But in this story in particular, I wanted to make sure that the Black family wasn't the sainted Black family that had bad things happen to them and or acted upon them, because then that puts them in a role of being the victim. And I also wanted to create empathy and sympathy for the Irish American family and what they were put through and how they went through life being part of an underclass in their town, not having enough money to get the things that they wanted, and not material things either. They're having some very serious struggles about just raising their children and trying to figure out how to do that in a society that seems to be stacked against them.
Hmm. And you were saying earlier how you found out that so much of this was shrouded in secrecy in your family. The parts that were difficult to sort of suss out, did you end up getting the actual stories, or did you have to fill in the blanks through other forms of research?
I filled in the blanks through other forms of research. The Huntington has a wonderful dramaturgical team that helped me do research once they had accepted the play to commission the play and develop the play. And then I also went back and talked to my mother and her brother and sister about their experiences in Arlington once they moved in. And that, I think, was rather painful. I know for my sisters and myself to listen to those stories years and years later, we never realized how violent it was for them as young children. I think you can, in your mind, you can think of maybe kids in high school getting into fights. But hearing my aunt, who was 5 when she started school there, talk about getting hurt going to school almost on a daily basis was really startling. And those are the stories that came out.
Actually, on that note, we've got a caller with a story. Again, we're talking about ghost buying and race and real estate in Boston in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and how that's changed through to today. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Alan, is calling from Charlton. You're on the air, Alan.
Yes. My parents kind of had a similar situation back in the 50s. They tried to buy a house in Wellesley before I was born. And apparently during the time of the transaction, the house being sold, there was a cross burned on the lawn to kind of give us the message we weren't going to be welcome there. It was my mother's Irish, my father's Chinese. He was a professional, he was a physician actually. So we ended up moving to Newton, and I grew up in Newton. They were more welcoming there. But it was absolutely something you don't hear about, you don't think about. In Massachusetts, but that's what it was.
Alan, thank you so much for your call. Interesting to hear that Alan's family member was a physician, because the Black husband in your play, Kirsten, is also a physician.
Yes, yes. I wanted to make sure that in the play, the couple, or the stereotypical type of couple you might want to live next door to you if it weren't for race in the 1950s. In America.
Hmm. Well, Kirsten, if you could just stand by for a moment, mm-hmm. I want to bring in another guest into this conversation. His name is David Harris, and he's managing director of the Charles Hamilton Houston Institute for Race and Justice at Harvard Law School. David Harris, welcome to you.
Good afternoon.
It's really wonderful to have you. Let me ask you, you've been hearing this issue about ghost buying in Boston. How does that fit into the bigger story of race and real estate in the second half of the 20th century here in Massachusetts?
Well, of course, probably as with all of your listeners, it's a fascinating story, and it's something that many of us grew up hearing about. It's interesting to hear Kirsten say that it was shrouded in mystery. I think many of us had heard stories of this kind of thing. It's consistent with other practices that took place in the Boston area and across the country that made housing systematically unavailable to people of color.
Well, I think one of the most well-known practices would be redlining.
Yes, redlining is the practice by which home mortgages were approved or not approved according to certain kinds of risks. And one of the most shocking things about the practice of redlining for many people is to realize that it's a policy or practice that grew out of official government policy. The Federal Home Administration was responsible for creating this practice, which made loans unavailable in communities of color and actually made them quite available in other communities and led to the creation of the suburbs, which were historically looking as they do now.
So it wasn't banks just denying loans, that they were doing it under the direction of the federal government.
Under the excuse me, guidelines that were presented by the government, yes. And the banks started to assume those same underwriting standards, but they originated with our government.
Hmm. But the redlining came to an end officially in 1968 with the Fair Housing Act?
Well, yes. I mean, it continued for a little while and took some litigation. The practices were very difficult to root out. But officially, redlining is illegal. The practice, it's interesting because some people see practices similar to redlining in the mortgage lending crisis, but officially it did end, yes.
Kirsten Greenidge, it was interesting to hear David Harris just say that practices were officially rooted out, but the behaviors they induced maybe not so officially rooted out, or those took time, because in your play, The Luck of the Irish, we witnessed 50 years of history and how the effects of the original act of ghost buying sort of trickle through the family over half a century. Would you describe what the effect is over time in the families in your play?
Well, as it exists in my play, we've got the family that's living there, and the grandchildren come back to help the grandparents. The grandparents pass away, and they are left in this house. And one thing that we were exploring in the play is the idea that the neighborhood didn't change, and that they're still, the family, the granddaughters, are still dealing with some of the same issues of integration and living side by side with people who might not look like you in the play.
We've got Mark David 66, who writes on RadioBoston.org, "When my folks bought their property in Pelham, New Hampshire in 1980, the owner didn't want to sell it to Jews, so their friend bought it for them." So another story there. Let's take a call from Dorchester, where Dennis is on the line. You're on the air, Dennis.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was just telling the person on that answered the telephone, I grew up in Dorchester, and I'm 52 years old, so I was in high school when busing came around, and there were many instances in which, I was attacked going to stores or going to, MBTA stations. But the reason why I called is because it reminded me when I was a young man, I was dating a woman from Weston, Massachusetts, not Western, but Weston. And she had, she was very liberal. She went to Harvard and everything, and we worked together. We became, a couple, and we were looking to move in together. And she wanted to live in Brookline over by Longwood Towers. And so I don't know if I'm supposed to mention that on the air, but I explained to her that she would have to get the lease by herself without me going up to the apartment. And she didn't understand. She kept saying, "But baby, how can you pick out an apartment without ever going in there?" I said, "Trust me, I'm going to trust your judgment. You go up there and buy it. You go up there and secure the apartment." So after she did it and she came downstairs and delivered the keys to me a couple weeks later, I was going in to show my brother the apartment. And as we walked into the front doors, the door people stop us and say, "Can I help you?" And I'm like, no, let me just go. I have my key. I know where I'm going. And then the manager comes down and she says, "Excuse me, can I help you?" And I says, "No, I live here." She says, "No, you don't." And I says, "Yes, I do." I told her my name, and then she kind of had this odd look on her face as if she recognized my name from the application.
Dennis, I'm going to jump in here because I got to ask you a quick question. Was the reaction you got because of your ethnicity, your race, your religion? What exactly were people reacting to, saying you couldn't live here?
I think it's because I'm black, I'm black, and I was walking through there. There was only one other black person that lived in the building at the time.
Dennis, thank you so much for your call. David Harris, there's yet another story of the lengths that people had to go to in order to find housing, and yet thereafter, the strong reaction they got from neighbors and the neighborhood. There's another sort of aspect to the race and real estate question in the Boston area that comes in the form of what was called sundowning or sundown towns. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, again, I'm not an expert on this, and I think it's one of these things that many people of color, African Americans, grow up hearing about. But it was effectively the notion or the idea that people of color weren't welcome in a town, and they really needed to be out of town before the sun went down. There was threat of violence. I think it was more common in other parts of the country, but there's some indication that there were some places in Massachusetts where that was the case. And it's an interesting premise. It really is basically the idea that people don't belong somewhere. Mm-hmm. And whether it's a sundown, whether it's you better be out of town before sundown, or fear for your life, or simply you don't belong here because of how you look, In that sense, we haven't come too far.
Kirsten Greenidge, there's a scene very early on in your play, The Luck of the Irish, where the Taylors, the Black family, describe what happened when they had purchased or rented a house in Newton. And the line that sticks with me is when they were saying that the bulbs weren't even...
bulbs weren't even cool. Yes, the bulbs were still cool when they moved in, meaning they had just turned on everything, dusk had just settled, and this is the apartment that they, or the house that they rented originally in Newton. It's mythical Newton, and they face the neighbors coming around and burning the lawn down. And in the play, the landlord asks them to leave, which is why in the play, plot wise, they think if we own a place, nobody can kick us out. We're just going to decide to stay.
Let's take another call here from Bill, who's calling from Needham. You're on the air, Bill.
Yes, hi. I have a story that's not from either side of the equation, but kind of in the middle. I'm a realtor, and when I started working in that job in the late 1980s, I worked in an office in Brookline, and it was my good fortune to work with a great lady by the name of Mickey Nathanson, who was a realtor since the mid-1950s, and she told me the story of she was working with Celtic great Bill Russell to find a home in Brookline in the early or mid-1960s, and by this point, Bill Russell was already a well-established star, one of the most loved Celtics at the time and continues to be. She was helping him find a home, and she received death threats from multiple sources over the time that she was working with him and even after. And Mickey said that she was never intimidated by those people. She and her husband would just hang up on them when they would call. It just has always amazed me that even a well-loved sports star as recently as the 1960s, it engendered that kind of hatred.
Bill, thank you so much for your call. An amazing story. David Harris, let me ask you, it's easy for us to look back on stories from the 60s, as Bill was sharing with us, and say, my goodness, isn't it wonderful how much things have changed? And yes, they have. But on the other hand, in the studies that you've done, there's obviously still contemporary forms of maybe unconscious or institutional forms of discrimination that exist in housing. Can you tell us a little bit about that, particularly when a phenomenon known as, or that you've done, called testing?
Yes, I want to echo what you just said, though. I think that it is a mixed picture. We have come a long way in many respects, and I think that's another aspect of the play I think that's important, is to recognize that we are all bound up in this history and we move forward or not together. There's a practice known as testing, which is where you send out a couple of people. It's not unlike ghost buying, who are in every respect except one, say race, pretty much equivalent. And you simply measure the kind of treatment that they receive. And studies consistently show that in these matched pair tests, about 50% of the time, it's likely that a person of color is going to be treated differently, either told that an apartment doesn't exist or that a home costs a different amount or that the amenities are withheld, or even sometimes that a person might be happier in another location, any of which are considered violations of the Fair Housing Act and are really designed to keep people from renting.
And you've done this testing in the Boston area and found that as much as 50% of the time these things happen?
We have, yes. Consistently over the last decade, the Fair Housing Center of Greater Boston has done testing on sales, rental, insurance, and find that the practice continues. I think picking up on something you said, there are two forms that these things take. One is the kind of overt kind of discrimination, and the other, we're starting to learn, has to do with implicit or unconscious bias, in which we operate based on certain schemas or associations we make with people and are unconscious that kind of carry forward in our actions and decisions on a conscious level. And so there's a real kind of tendency for us to think that we really have gone a lot farther than we have.
Hmm. You know, it's interesting because, yeah, on the flip side, if I may, both you and Kirsten happen to live in the same neighborhood now. You both live in West Medford.
We do. I have to meet Kirsten.
And I wonder, I mean, that community has a very interesting story of its own. And why, I'll start with you, Kirsten, why did you decide to live in West Medford?
Well, originally it was because my husband worked at Bistro 5 in West Medford, and he wanted to be able to walk to work because we had one car.
Great commute.
And it was great commute. It was 3 minutes with him walking briskly. And we found an apartment, and it worked out well. We didn't realize how wonderful and diverse and unique that particular area is to Boston, to the suburbs of Boston.
And David, your choice for West Medford?
Well, we were looking for a place, to tell you the truth. I don't want to say too much because I don't want too many people coming out here. But, we have a house that was very reasonably priced that's about 100 yards from the Mystic River and a half a mile from Mystic Lake, but also is a long-term integrated neighborhood with a very comfortable and established black population that we found very, very welcoming, and we were very concerned and interested in being able to do that. I'll tell you a funny story about it, though. When we went to buy the house, some friends, everybody thought, well, we should go across the river and buy in Arlington. The property values are much higher, and you can get your house much cheaper in West Medford. Why would you want to do that? And for us, it was a twofer, right? We could get the house cheaper. We could be around people we wanted to be around, and it's just a marvelous community, and it's an example of what's possible if we can open our communities.
David Harris is Managing Director of the Charles Hamilton Houston Institute for Race and Justice at Harvard Law School. Mr. Harris, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And Kirsten Greenidge, playwright of The Luck of the Irish, which is open now at the Huntington Theater. Great to have you. Thank you so much, and great play.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
Next week on Radio Boston, a story about a washed-up pitcher and how baseball gave us jazz. That's next week on Radio Boston.
Radio Boston is a production of WBUR with regular contributions from The Angle at boston.com. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Have a great weekend. Join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.